from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. President Donald Trump went after Special Counsel Robert Mueller on Twitter yesterday, by name for the first time. Is a firing in the works, and would it fly with Republicans? Senator Lindsey Graham warns no.
If he tried to do that, that would be the beginning and the end of his presidency, because we're a rule of law nation.
Also, Facebook is under fire from politicians in the U.S. and the U.K. for improperly harvested data reportedly used to influence voters in the 2016 U.S. election. We'll get the latest on our weekly news roundup next, after this. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Lawmakers in Washington are calling for hearings on reports of improperly harvested data at Facebook, which was used by a Trump-linked data analysis firm. The social media company on Friday suspended accounts linked to Cambridge Analytica over allegations it held onto improperly obtained user data after telling Facebook it had deleted it. The data analysis firm worked for President Trump during the 2016 campaign. And in today's Monday morning political roundup, we'll talk about the Facebook story as well as getting the latest on the Russia investigation, which took more turns over the weekend after the firing of FBI Director, Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. Now there are questions about whether Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller is next. Let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. David McCune's here in studio. He's professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Sonoma State. David McCune, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Jennifer Epstein, who is with us from Washington. She's White House reporter for Bloomberg. Welcome, Jennifer Epstein.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And we will be joined later on in this hour by Scott Shane, reporter with the Washington Bureau for the New York Times. Let me go to you first, Jennifer Epstein. It seems as if we're trying to sort of piece it together here and figure out what it seems like as opposed to what it is. But the Trump administration seems to be digging in, and really in many ways through the tweets of the president and through his private attorney, John Dowd, talking about how the Mueller investigation should end. There's a lot of speculation that they are pushing for exactly that, or at least to some degree, having this thing wrap up as the president's lawyer said it was going to.
Yeah, you know, the president's lawyers since, you know, maybe 6 months ago have been saying this is going to end very soon. I remember around Thanksgiving, people close to the president were saying this whole thing would be done by the end of the year. And then it became by Easter because, you know, of course, staff are going to want to spend their Easter vacations with their families. It doesn't look like it's going to wrap up by Easter. That would be about 2 weeks from now. It does seem like there are lots more pieces of this puzzle that are going to be coming from Mueller. There, you know, more indictments, more subpoenas. You know, we just saw last week that in recent weeks, there have been some subpoenas for documents related to the Trump Organization's work with Russians and Russian firms. This is not something that is coming to an end from within the Mueller team anytime soon, which is why, you know, we're all kind of on the outside, journalists, analysts, you know, members of the public are all kind of saying, okay, well, Trump wants this to be over. He doesn't seem like Mueller is ready for it to be over. So what is the president going to do? And then when you see him tweeting as he did over this weekend, where he, for the first time, really went after Mueller directly, didn't just say it's a witch hunt, it's Mueller and his team of Democrats, that you begin to see where this could go. And then, of course, you have Ty Cobb from the White House counsel's office last night putting out a statement saying the president is not considering or discussing firing Mueller. But anything is possible with this president. I think we've seen that time and time again. And when you're seeing somebody who seems to be emboldened overall in his personnel choices, you know, firing Rex Tillerson, seeming to be on the edge of getting rid of a whole lot of other people, it does seem like a logical place to go.
It's also perhaps logical in the wake of the fact that a list of questions have been submitted to President Trump by Special Investigator Mueller. And the reality is that you were talking about his tweets. He was naming Mueller by name, as you implied, for the first time, and also talking about the fact that there were 13 hardened Democrats, I'm using his language now, behind crooked Hillary. And the reality is that he seems to be at this point striking back and trying really to some extent to undermine the investigation. But I wanted to also ask you, Jennifer, about this other narrative that we're hearing from the White House. It's basically the Daryl Issa narrative, and it's about FISA. And that seems to be, along with the Republican Congressional Committee not coming out in any way against the president, more ammunition for him.
Yeah, you know, the president is certainly pointing to, and the president's allies are pointing to what they believe to be, you know, corruption, basically, within the FBI and other intelligence agencies. You know, they point to the House Intelligence Committee's findings, which the president has summarized as being no collusion. But you saw just in the last couple of days, senior members of that committee on the Republican side saying that they weren't actually investigating that very question of collusion, but yet that's the conclusion that the president was able to pull from it, you know, and that seems to be where this the president is going with this, is to undermine the people who are investigating him at any cost, even if it is, you know, Americans losing more trust in the rule of law and in the agencies that are meant to protect them, that serves the president's purpose, saying that the deep state is against him, that people in his orbit who are U.S. citizens were improperly surveilled. All those things come together to serve the president's interests, but maybe or maybe not the public's larger interests. Depends on sort of your perspective on it and whether you think that he's right on in this, and that there's a lot of dangerous stuff happening within the government at this angle.
Again, Jennifer Epstein with us from the nation's capital as White House reporter for Bloomberg, and David McEwen's here in studio. He's professor and chair of political science at Sonoma State. It would seem also, David, as if there's been a red line crossed here. They're subpoenaing business records of President Trump.
Yeah, we really have.
He called that as a red line.
Yeah. That's right. He called that as a red line. And we really have entered a period where we not only have a number of personnel changes over the last 3 weeks. We're in the primary season. We're headed to a general election in November where Democrats are sensing some momentum in the House. And so the White House really has to really kind of build a fence around and move hard against Bob Mueller. They've done that, but it also is going to cost them at some level. But it doesn't seem, you got to remember the model here of the president and the Trump base. They rally around him and hold hard and fast. If they can grab some of those independent voters, just a few, they think they can run the country with 36% approval rating.
Recently it's gone up a bit to 38, I think, or 39.
Right. That's exactly right. But nonetheless, they're going to hold and run in this very hard fashion. And that's because the calendar doesn't work against them. This is why they have to push Bob Mueller about this, because they rapidly run out of room. That makes Hill Republicans nervous. It makes their whole legislative program quite nervous. And if you're also in the cabinet, you've got to be worried about whether you're going to be in favor or out of favor via the Twitterverse and what happens there as well.
Well, he's essentially made this into a partisan fight in many respects, but one has to remember the fact that Mueller is a Republican, that McCabe is a Republican, that Rosenstein is a Republican. This doesn't seem to weigh into the... And what strikes me, and I'm interested in your take on this, is when the president keeps saying this mantra over and over again, no collusion, you have to ask yourself, does he really know? I mean, give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he wasn't colluding, but others in his campaign may have been colluding.
That's right. And he might not have been aware of that. And collusion is a difficult task for Bob Mueller to demonstrate. But obstruction is a task that he can and seems to have focused on. So in some ways, his investigation has changed. I think that's why you've seen a change in strategy of the White House, because obstruction after the election itself or around the campaign is going to be much easier to demonstrate from a legal standpoint. It's going to go a lot further. Collusion is going to be a much harder sell, and that's going to be much more difficult because the president can say he didn't have personal knowledge of it and those around him, which gives him an out.
But you do see this perhaps moving more toward obstruction of justice and things that were done post-campaign?
Yeah, I think you're clearly moving to an obstruction of justice type campaign. And if it's obstruction of justice, that is really goes to the base of how Bob Mueller has constructed his team. And that will be very difficult for people like Ty Cobb and the White House to have not only a political message, but also a legal message that they can that doesn't end up getting settled by the U.S. Supreme Court. So all the key actors are going to be involved in here. And this is really going to turn up over the next 6 to 8 months.
And we have, let me go back to you on this, Jennifer Epstein. We have not only the memos of James Comey, but now the memos of Andrew McCabe, right?
Right. McCabe said after his firing that he was keeping notes about the Comey firing and about his various interactions with more senior officials. This is not a position that the president should want to be in, where he has all of these, reliable or relatively reliable law enforcement sources who, know how to handle an investigation, whether they're a part of that as, a part of that investigation or whether they're doing the investigation, who can say the president stepped over the line here or one of his aides did this thing. All of that seems to be potentially very, very dangerous for the president, and it seems like he doesn't seem to be worried about that at all.
There's also, and we're going to in a moment bring Scott Shane into this, but David McEwen, there's also contrasting testimony coming out about what Attorney General Sessions said about his role in the campaign in Russia.
Yeah, the Attorney General has been all over the map, both on the record and off the record, and really in closed session, about his role in interactions with the Russian foreign minister, with the Russian ambassador, his role in interaction with the Russians throughout the campaign. That's going to, the lack of candor about that is going to hurt Jeff Sessions when he deals with his former colleagues in the Senate. And so he's someone to watch, whether H.R. McMaster is in or out. All of this kind of isolation that the president is going through in terms of isolating himself and those around him and really moving forward on a harder line is going to affect a whole host of issues, foreign policy issues like Iran and interactions on Capitol Hill. Usually we see this about year six of a presidency. We don't see this 14, 15 months in. And that gives you an idea of the chaos and pandemonium of the Trump administration so far.
Well, we're doing our Monday morning political roundup. David McEwen's here in studio, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Sonoma State. And Jennifer Epstein's with us from D.C., White House reporter for Bloomberg. And Scott Shannon is joining us, reporter for the Washington Bureau with the New York Times, also the author of Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. And good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you. Actually, I'd like our listeners to hear something before we go to you, Scott. This is California Congressman Adam Schiff, top Democrat in the House Intelligence Committee, and he's among those calling for Facebook to testify before Congress, and we'll talk about what's going on with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica with Scott Chain, but I want you to hear this cut first. He spoke with KQED about Facebook just this weekend. Let's listen.
I think Facebook should come back and testify before Congress. I also think we need to bring in the whistleblower, and I'll be inviting him to come testify before a committee, whether the Republicans show up or not. It's why it's such a disservice, frankly, that the Republicans race to shut down our investigation.
So, Scott Shane, we're talking kind of on two levels here about the ongoing investigation, but also let's talk about this latest that's come out with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. I mean, they were harvesting information for over 50 million Facebook profiles without essentially alerting those who are on Facebook. That's kind of the basic of it, isn't it?
Yes, that's the gist of it. And, I mean, there was an argument, kind of ongoing argument with Facebook, between Facebook and my colleagues here at the New York Times, over whether one could call this a breach or not. And Facebook's point was, well, we weren't hacked. Actually, what happened was that they, according to Facebook at least, that they had an agreement to give some data to researchers, and that the researchers then, without telling them and, unethically, passed the data on to Cambridge Analytica for a commercial use. And but certainly in the common days, everyday sense of the term, it was a breach. Another one of these you know, a completely different breach from, say, Equifax or some of these hacks that we've seen in the past, but a very consequential breach and yet another blow to Facebook's reputation. You know, it's almost hard to remember now, but a few short years ago, just about all the press about Facebook was positive. It was the place where you could connect with your friends and family. And
friends and family, you know, connect the whole world, according to Mark Zuckerberg.
They connect the whole world, yeah. And it, along with Twitter, was credited to some degree in 2011 with the Arab Spring, the Arab Awakening, that it was sort of a tool for democracy that people could use to organize against authoritarian governments. Now, you've had this series of stories, it's the sort of role of Facebook in spreading false news stories, fake news. You've had the Russian exploitation of the, you know, on a really pretty grand scale, putting out these divisive memes, so-called memes, from Facebook pages that were in the Facebook feeds of 126 million Americans. And now you have this Cambridge Analytica story. So it's growing pains is sort of the mild version. This is obviously a huge company with a huge reach, and it started life essentially saying, we're just a platform where you can put your stuff, and don't hold us responsible for you, for the stuff that you put there. And they've gradually been forced to be accountable for what people put on their site, in part because some of the people putting it there are, you know, criminals and foreign intelligence agencies.
Well, the New York Times deserves some kudos for breaking this story, but Facebook's position on this is it's not a breach, and yet there are certainly many people who are rightfully concerned about the platform not being safe.
Yeah, if my data, if data about me that I had given to Facebook, put on Facebook, was given to Cambridge Analytica as a result of this, it's certainly a breach from my point of view. It may not be a technical breach the way hacking is a technical breach, but the consequences are the same. A private company, and God knows who else, now has my data that I shared with Facebook.
You want to comment on this, David McEwen?
Yeah, I think that if there's a couple of rules here. One is that if you're tweeting a defense, if you're from Facebook and it's about what constitutes a breach, you've already lost the public relations war.
Yes, yes.
That's just not a place you want to be from a public affairs campaign. And this has been going on for Facebook for some time. It's always a mea culpa over the last year. They need to get ahead of this, which is why I think you see Mark Zuckerberg on Capitol Hill. The other rule here is that anything that you put online, you have to expect that it's going to go far and wide. And that's exactly what's happened in this case.
Well, Jennifer Epstein, if I can go back to you, this Facebook story, how does it tie in, do you think, or in what ways does it tie into the Mueller investigation?
Well, it ties in that you're dealing with a lot of the same players on the Trump side, that this is a firm that was founded by the Mercers, huge donor, biggest donor to the Trump campaign in 2016 and the supporting efforts. Steve Bannon was a key part of this firm. Jared Kushner helped bring the firm to the Trump campaign. Brad Parscale was involved in that as kind of the head of digital for the campaign. He now has been announced as the 2020 campaign manager for Trump. All these people and things are very interconnected. And then when you take into consideration the Russian ties of the professor who was involved in what I would agree was, you know, to a consumer, a data breach, you're dealing with maybe not the same issues as the collusion sort of angle that Mueller is going at this, but certainly, very much in the same ballpark of sort of improper use of information, foreign actors potentially being involved in U.S. politics, and that's an unusual place to be. And I would also note, investors don't seem to be having much confidence in how Facebook is responding to this. It's down about 7% in trading today so far. And this is really something that so far Facebook and the other big tech companies have not found a way to get ahead of, and they really have struggled, and because they either have proprietary information that they don't want to put out there about just how much data and just how many people's privacy has been infringed upon, or how many people have seen manipulative ads or other content. Or they just don't even have that information, and that's a place where these companies are right now, and they haven't really had to have an ethical reckoning, but it does seem like they're getting closer and closer to one.
I want to bring our listeners into this, and if you would like to join this conversation, or you have something you'd like to add or have a question or a comment, please feel free to do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you, and let me give you that number. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your involvement in the program. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, you can join us now at 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum and click on the segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. And Jennifer Epstein, I know we have to say goodbye to you, so I'd just like to leave with one question here, and that is what's popping into my mind is the fact that big news yesterday, we're doing a news roundup, and I didn't even mention, because there's so many things close to home, that Vladimir Putin was reelected by about 72% as the crow flies. We don't know that. Little opposition. Claims, by the way, of widespread violation and utter fraud, including ballot box stuffing. And you have to ask at this point, to what extent is the Trump administration going to answer? Because at this point, there's no admission of Russian meddling in our election, is there, officially from the Trump
administration? No, there isn't. And you have the Trump administration repeatedly saying that they're more focused on 2018, but then they won't say what they're actually doing to prevent meddling in the midterm elections or in the 2020 election. There's been no real condemnation, no strong condemnation coming directly from the president. You've seen some members of the cabinet or other members of the administration, H.R. McMaster, the national security advisor, or the now former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, occasionally condemning small pieces of the Russia story, but to hear it directly from the president is something that has not happened, and he seems to be very reluctant to do, because even if he sees that there and has been shown intelligence, I'm sure that backs up meddling in 2016 and so on, he is afraid to do anything that undermines his victory then, which he still recounts all the time as the greatest victory of all time.
Since before I let you go here, and we have to go to a break, since you mentioned H.R. McMaster, there's a lot of buzz about his being shown the door as well and being replaced by John Bolton. What do you hear on that? Anything specific?
It seems like it's a matter of when and not if, though there really have been rumors about McMaster being out for maybe more than 6 months at this point. It seems like he and the president don't really get along stylistically, but at the same time, they're now in these North Korea talks, and it may be something that he sticks around for and then leaves.
Jennifer Epstein, thank you so much for joining us on Forum this morning.
Thanks.
Good to have you. Jennifer Epstein is White House reporter for Bloomberg. We're going to continue with Scott Shane, reporter for the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, and David McEwen here in studio, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Sonoma State. And again, you can join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. And you're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is our Monday morning political roundup, and we're joined this hour by Scott Shane, who is a reporter of the Washington Bureau with the New York Times, author of Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone, and David McEwen, who's here in studio, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Sonoma State University. We had Jennifer Epstein on earlier, White House reporter with Bloomberg, and we are going to go to your calls and emails here forthwith. I want to go to a couple of other things, though, since this is a fairly expansive news roundup. We've been concentrating, of course, on the Russia investigation and Facebook. But let me go to you on this, Scott Shane, because you've been covering it a lot. And I'm talking about the ascendancy now of Mike Pompeo, if you call it ascendancy, from head of the CIA to the Office of Secretary of State, and just wondering what it means particularly in terms of, I mean, there's been a lot of speculation, but ultimately with respect to the Iran treaty. He's been very opposed to it, and so has President Trump.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Mike Pompeo will be the first person to serve as CIA director and then go on to become Secretary of State, so he's kind of moving from the spy world into the world of diplomacy. But you kind of have to say that Rex Tillerson, the outgoing Secretary of State, was really somewhat more diplomatic about some of these hot issues around the world than Mike Pompeo. Mike Pompeo has actually tweeted when President Trump was elected, "I look forward to rolling back this disastrous deal with the world's largest state sponsor of terrorism," the Iran deal, that is. And, you know, while it's CIA really has not moderated his rhetoric, and some months back he called Iran in a speech a despotic theocracy and a pernicious empire that is expanding its power and influence across the Middle East. That's a you know, diagnosis that a lot of people would agree with, but it's very, very strongly stated. So how this is going to play out, you know, it's a little bit hard to know. He's America's chief diplomat. Obviously, the previous administration of Barack Obama considered the Iran deal to be a triumph of diplomacy that had kicked the Iranian nuclear weapons threat down the road many years. And President Trump and Mike Pompeo have been extremely critical of the deal, but it's always a little bit unclear as to what they propose in its place. So we'll just have to see how that plays out. And in the role of Secretary of State, how, you know, he would be if he tries to essentially exit the Iran deal, he's going to get a lot of pushback from American allies, especially in Europe, who worked with the United States for many years on that treaty, so on that agreement. So you know, will he want to offend all these all the other foreign ministers in the world right off the bat? We'll get a chance to find out.
Well, he may offend people in the Muslim world, because a lot of his rhetoric, especially when he was a Tea Party Republican in Kansas, was pretty severe and harshly anti-Muslim. There's also, I think, an important fact about Mike Pompeo that a lot of people have not been highlighting. He's one of these strong doubters of climate change.
Yes, all of the above. I mean, he was actually, as a congressman from Kansas, he was, you know, sort of sponsored by the Koch brothers, who, of course, have oil interests and chemical interests and have financed a lot of research and, you know, agitation against, you know, sort of a serious approach to climate change, taking climate change seriously. So he definitely comes from that world. On the other hand, Rex Tillerson was seen as, you know, perhaps somewhat inexplicably, from a guy who'd been the head of Exxon, quite an incompetent manager of this large, sprawling bureaucracy that the State Department represents. And some of this seems to have been related to his notion that the State Department was too big and should be cut way back. But in any case, you know, he failed to essentially fill the spots in the bureaucracy that make the wheels turn over there. And so many people, the State Department, have felt like they are just sort of twiddling their thumbs and not getting anywhere because they don't have direction. The sort of deputy assistant secretary level is very sparsely populated. And Mike Pompeo is seen as somebody who is more of a manager and more likely to make the State Department function again, even if the direction he takes it may alarm some folks who are there now.
Well, he's closer to the president, obviously, than Tillerson was, and there's speculation that maybe some of those jobs might be coming back. There may be jobs for diplomats once again, but let me, before I go to calls and emails, go back to David McEwen, who's here with us in studio, and I'd like to talk a little bit about politics with you, David, because we're still kind of evaluating the Pennsylvania race and what it means in the big picture. And I, just for a review of listeners, Connor Lamb probably won that election. Hasn't been officially called yet. And he's a Democrat and a very attractive candidate to many people, a Marine, a U.S. attorney. But also, he beat the Republican in a state where Trump was 20% ahead in the vote against Hillary Clinton. What I'm interested to hear is, do you see this in some ways taking place along the lines of, we're going to do what he did. We're going to get the best candidates, kind of disassociate from Nancy Pelosi, which he did. Mm-hmm. Also take stronger positions in a hybridized way that are not necessarily pro-gun control, right, but more balanced on gun, those kinds of things. In other words, that reach out more to the GOP voters or the Trump voters.
Yeah, Democrats are going to be searching for candidates like Connor Lamb, candidates who can embrace guns, if that's the right term, for some of those folks. They will be more moderate on abortion. They will be less litmus driven, if you will, by some of the liberal issues or liberal core on the Democratic Party. But the Democratic Party has to resolve that. The degree to which there's a generational change going on, Connor Lamb represents that. Eric Swalwell here in the Bay Area represents that. Versus those that are entrenched in the Democratic establishment, obviously epitomized by San Francisco's own Nancy Pelosi. How that all stands moving forward will be an important element for winning those congressional races in the state of California, because the way Democrats are going to win the House is really through the pathway of those districts in the Valley and Southern California. And so far, they're raising plenty of money that way. The question is, will they have the right candidates, or will they go after each other? That will be a problem.
The latter seems to be the case right now, doesn't it?
That's right.
It's pretty fragmented.
It is pretty fragmented. And they really haven't resolved that fundamental problem between establishment Democrats, say the Clinton wing, Tom Perez, and those that are on the Bernie side of the campaign. We see that even in California, and we see that nationwide. Democrats need to have that message if they're going to retake the House.
Let me bring our callers into this. And Shane, we begin with you. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you. You know, just going back to, you know, the information that was released from the Trump or to the Trump campaign by the company, Nate Silver had a comment on Twitter saying that the actual information that was released was not that detailed compared to, you know, the rest of the information that's available to companies at all different times. So I think, you know, this might be a little bit of a much ado about nothing, or it might also be, you know, a symbol of just how much detailed information is available out there. And I'm a big Facebook, you know, person. I go on Facebook all the time, and I like it.
You're starting to break up here, but let me go to Scott Shane on the point that you just made, Shane, and I thank you for that, Scott.
Yeah, I mean, I think we don't know exactly what information changed hands here from the Facebook users, the 50 million Facebook users. But I think in some ways it's the larger issue here may not be the specific fact about specific individuals on Facebook. It may be the larger question of trust in Facebook. I mean, Facebook is a company that we entrust a lot of information, very personal information, family information, friend information, and that in recent years has emphasized, you know, all the options they give you to protect your privacy. And so this is a huge blow to Facebook's reputation. I think that may be more important ultimately than any particular case in which a particular fact about an individual, you know, causes some kind of a problem.
Let me bring another caller aboard here. And David, that's you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I'm wondering why nobody has brought up Dr. Marcel Kucinich's name, professor at Stanford, who I think it was 2013, did a My Personality sort of contest or deal on Facebook, whereby he got 6 million people to tell everything about themselves, and of course kept all that data on hand, and plus he's also vice president of Cambridge Analytica, and that The way they advertise or the way they mark is they go after these gun owners, conservatives, doesn't make any difference, Republican or Democrat. And what they do is they've got, if you're a voter in this country right here, right now, and they even say everybody in the country has somewhere between 2,000 and 5,000 data points, that Cambridge Analytica has on all of us. And then they, quote-unquote, advertise they can pinpoint individually so-called advertising. I believe they call them dark spots, where they just put something up, kind of like they did with Hillary, with that pizza place in New Jersey that was running an abortion thing or whatever they were supposedly running out of there. And then after 45 minutes, those dark spots disappear from your computer and can no longer be traced. And that's how they got Trump in you know, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. And
yeah, David, you're raising a number of points here. Let me go back to you on this, Scott Shane, because I know you have to leave us in a matter of minutes here. Let's talk about Cambridge Analytica's role in this, and if you know Marcel Kucinich, how he plays into it.
I really do not know. I can say that most of the reporters who looked at the prior to this, most reporters who looked at the role of Cambridge Analytica in the 2016 election in terms of assistance they gave to Trump, most people who looked at that were kind of underwhelmed. They actually thought that Cambridge Analytica was exaggerating its powers and its contribution and sort of, you know, taking more credit for Trump's victory than the facts justified. But I think more generically, the value of data, the value of detailed data about individuals of the kind that you can get from Facebook is huge. I mean, that's why companies like Facebook and Google and Amazon are, you know, the biggest companies around now, because they can commercialize this data that's collected about individuals and use it essentially to sell stuff to you, whether that is, you know, a laundry detergent or a presidential candidate. So I mean, I think the caller's general point is very well taken.
Scott Shane, I know you have to leave. I thank you for being with us. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Scott Shane is reporter with the Washington Bureau, the New York Times, and we're going to continue with your calls and emails. David McEwen here with us, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Sonoma State. Let me I'm going to read a tweet, and I'll just read this without any comment, but then go to another email that I see sort of in conjunction with it and get your response, David. Listener tweets, the only reason for this investigation is that some people want Trump out because he dares to oppose them. I am going to enjoy when this farce ends. Now, here's Dave who writes, if obstruction of justice is the only charge, it seems clear that a Democratic House would vote to impeach. You think that obstruction of justice is strong enough charge to swing Republican senators to vote to convict and remove, or will it take something stronger such as collusion?
Yeah, I think that goes right to the heart of the dilemma that Democrats face. If Democrats were to win the House, needing those 24 seats and riding some type of wave into the fall, and now we're in January, what do you do? There's going to be elements of the party that are going to want to impress investigations leading to impeachment, but there are a lot of very serious Democrats in Washington, D.C. that don't want to move into that fair wind, and that'll be difficult. Democrats really want to have this as a talking point headed into 2020, whereas impeachment will be incredibly divisive. It will put many Democrats who are looking to the national ticket and national race in 2020 really in an uncomfortable place while activists are calling for this. Obstruction clearly seems to be the place that Bob Mueller is headed, collusion being too difficult. But is that enough really to move the politics on this? That's why I think that the short-term game here is all about Democrats trying to gain some political leverage, but the longer-term legal game can spin out for a long, long time, well past 2018 into 1920, and a lot of Democrats don't mind that as long as it doesn't lead to impeachment.
Well, as long as you provided that political context, let me read a remark by a listener named Rad, who says, there is no way you can convince me that Facebook doesn't possess the ability to completely control or shut down all this fake news and meddling using their platform. They chose not to because it makes them money. They better start accepting responsibility and get it under control for the upcoming midterms.
Yeah, I think that one thing we haven't mentioned here as well is how important that is for suburban voters. We talked about Connor Lamb and what happened in Pennsylvania, but in other districts, and how that Facebook data is handled for suburban female voters, those that may be independent-minded and don't really like the chaos that's going on or uncertain about where things are going with Russia. That is where the Facebook leverage can be used on those persuadable voters. That's how we saw it in 2008, 2012, and certainly come to fruition with the Trump election in 2016.
I'll see you if you agree with another listener comment here. This listener writes, Donald Trump's firing of Andy McCabe less than 2 days before his qualification for pension after serving the country for over 20 years was extremely cruel, vindictive, and totally counterproductive to Donald Trump's own interests. Actually, it was technically Attorney General Sessions who fired McCabe, right, but presumably at the president's behest. In fact, the president said it was a triumph for democracy. That was his response to it. I'm still trying to figure out the logic of that. But it gets back to that other narrative, I guess, about FISA, doesn't it?
Yeah, it gets back to the other narrative about FISA, but also how the White House is pushing back on all of this. And McCabe is going to become, together with James Comey, when he releases his book here in just a few weeks, they're going to become really some of the administration's worst nightmares. They have those contemporaneous notes. They've turned those over to Bob Mueller. But they'll be able to control the narrative while the White House pushes back. All the while, the legislative program goes sideways. What happens with the Iranian nuclear deal that you talked about? What happens with North Korea? All these other very serious issues that this administration has to deal with, all these balls in the air. They haven't shown a capability to do that so far.
And here's Scott, who asks, what about the Mercer family that funded this Cambridge Facebook fiasco? I mean, they were at the center of it with Steve Bannon from the beginning and Jared Kushner. Yeah.
Right. And they'll continue to be involved. They've pledged a huge number of dollars. You also have the Koch brothers, who have pledged with their organization up to $470 million for the midterm elections, $500 million to maintain the House, just to give you some idea of the stakes that are here. So I think that while Cambridge Analytica may go sideways, Facebook may have public affairs, public relations issues. Nonetheless, big data and small data applied to small segments of the voters, that's going to continue to be the future.
Let's bring another caller aboard here. Javier joins us next. Javier, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. So I think it's very special to pay attention to the word usage. The media keeps on saying meddling. They never say voter fraud. There's no proof of voter fraud. I'm not a Trump supporter, but the U.S. has been meddling for decades in other nations' elections. So is it wrong for a foreign nation to, you know, try and influence the U.S.? I mean, Hillary Clinton was even receiving donations from Saudi Arabia via the Clinton Foundation in one way or another. So meddling isn't such a big deal. This wasn't fraud. So I don't get that anymore. And I'm not.
Now, I understand the point, and a number of people feel and have brought up the fact that the United States has been meddling and interfering with elections for a long time. There's no doubt about that. You want to comment here, though, David?
Well, we also have federal law, which is supposed to prohibit that, and we don't know the full extent of the technology that's been used. You know, the whole idea of the bots and the memes, that's been the important component here. If 84-85% of what you're seeing on Facebook are dropped by bots that are set by bots and originate from one or two places overseas, that's an important component of setting the narrative for those persuadable voters on the margin. And that's something that is be difficult to suss out. But that's the whole purpose of these investigations.
Well, the caller has a point. I mean, the United States has been involved in other elections historically for many years.
And the Russians have been involved for decades in Europe.
That's right.
With those elections.
And continue to be. What strikes me is, I don't know if you saw this, Terry McAuliffe was want to send over to Silicon Valley. He sent one of these voting machines. You know about this story?
No, I do not.
Well, you know, they talked about the voting machines being sort of beyond meddling into. I'll use that word advisedly. And McAuliffe sent one over to Silicon Valley. It was about 20 years old. And they cracked it in a matter of minutes.
Yeah, I would imagine that any of that technology, whether we're going to be voting through the iPhones or Android devices, all of this technology, it's never going to be data completely safe. And that's something to think about as we headed to 2018, 2020. Now, the administration has talked about at least paying attention to this. But as Jennifer Epstein talked about, they haven't been specific about what they're doing. So the narrative is attention to the election and election fraud and election security. How we actually get there is uncertain. And we're going to need the talent of people like those in Silicon Valley, those at Facebook, who clearly have egg on their face with what's going on with the data breach.
Well, you need to use the talents of Facebook in a different way, perhaps. Guy writes, from its founding under Hoover, the FBI has had a tradition of political interference and intimidation. The impartial inspector general has made accusations of improper conduct on the part of McCabe. Does this not give credence to Trump's claim that there's a swamp to be drained?
Well, I mean, I think you have to think about this in the broader narrative. And the broader narrative is that the Russians are our friends. There's a lot of folks in the military, in the foreign policy and intelligence communities that would argue that that's not the case, that the FBI is not to be trusted. Okay, there's a long history of that, even in the Bay Area, of paying attention. But to assault the law enforcement community, to assault that Russia, or change the narrative that Putin is with us with some common interests, all of that is a narrative coming out of the White House that is somewhat difficult to really kind of take at face value while you have upheaval and chaos going on in the White House and by the staffing models, and a president who likes to gain attention and control the media narrative via Twitter and not actually answering questions or engaged in what's happening before the press itself.
What's your sense of the impact of over the weekend? John Brennan talked about President Trump as a disgraced demagogue. Retired General Barry McCaffrey, very highly regarded and a man who is seen as being of real rectitude, came out and criticized the president harshly, strongly. What kind of effect does this have?
Yeah, I think that if you look at John Brennan's comments, given his background and General McCaffrey's comments, these were very serious people who went out on the Twitterverse in offensive and difficult and harsh language towards the president of the United States. Given the changes that happen, if H.R. McMaster is out, that puts a tremendous amount of pressure on Secretary of Defense Mattis. And that changes because the whole idea was that General Mattis, General McMaster, and obviously Rex Tillerson were the axis of adults who were going to check the president's worst impulses. Now, if General Kelly leaves, who knows what happens in the midst of all this Russia investigation. What these people are worried about is the emotionality of the president and the emotional context of the president going off the rails and dragging America into places that it doesn't want to go.
One other argument about American involvement in elections is that America was doing this, because I've seen this argument, I'm sure you have too, America was doing this, it's an old argument, on behalf of democracies while the Russians are doing it on behalf of essentially moving forward authoritarianism, or at least Russia's interests, against democracy.
That's right, as evidenced perhaps by Putin's either 72, 75, or 77% of the vote of the election that was held, of course, over the weekend.
And we'll bring another caller on here. Let's go to you, Aaron. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I would just like to make the point that although there's been many calls for Donald Trump to be held accountable, we really haven't heard any calls for Mark Zuckerberg to be held personally accountable for his actions here. And I have a particular reason for framing it that way, which is that I know Mark. I was the initial developer of the Facebook at Harvard in 2003. And I have never found him to be fit to be the CEO of a publicly traded company. I've said this for many years. And I think most unfortunately, we're seeing the results now of leaving someone like him in place running such a powerful organization. And if you look back historically, this is not at all a surprise. I had a conversation with him in 2005 about the goal of growth versus security, essentially quality versus quantity. He's always focused exclusively on growth, even to the detriment of our democracy, I think. And he also has always had this very worrying view about security flaws, that it's not really his problem. It can be blamed on someone else. It's not that big of a deal. And there are IM conversations to prove it. And these have just been glossed over by the media for years and years. And I think it's most unfortunate.
I'm glad you had your say, and I thank you for the call, Aaron. Appreciate hearing from you. This, I'm almost reluctant to bring this up, but it's part of the news analysis that we're looking at in the big picture here. Stormy Daniels?
Right. We are a week out from Stormy Daniels. We are at some period of time where obviously, Facebook will play a huge role in the conversation around that, both before and after. And this crisis-driven White House, these moments of really kind of dirty, ugly politics, negative mobilization, we call it in academia, that's where we find ourselves today. And it won't only be Stormy Daniels. It will be other episodes or other individuals that will spin out from that. So the spillover here. The spillover from the negative coverage or negative actions of Facebook, whether or not they were involved, all of that plays an important role moving forward. And I think Aaron brought up a huge, huge important point. And that's where someone like Mark Zuckerberg, who was mentioned often as a short list of a potential Democratic candidates in 2020, has to get on Capitol Hill and testify. And they have to get ahead of this. And Facebook has been unable to do that.
They've also been unable in many respects to sort of define how they can better regulate. I mean, obviously, they want to keep from being regulated by Congress, but they don't have any kind of provisos as to what to do and how to do it.
Yeah, I think that what you're seeing is, this is Amy Klobuchar, was mentioned on NPR this morning, is trying to move forward together with Senator Kennedy of Louisiana, Republican, on getting some legislation that really pushes forward and treats entities like Twitter and like Facebook as media organizations and media entities, media companies, having some of the same rules and not essentially kind of free agents. And that's where they operate now. They've been able to take advantage of this. They're headed to a new regulatory structure as a result of whatever ever happened with Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to sound glib about this, but the fact is, you know, we keep hearing from the president, no collusion. We keep hearing from Facebook, no breach. And this is, like I say, this sounds like mantras almost.
Yeah, they are. They'll hold on to those mantras at least as long as possible. But clearly the models are moving and changing, and public opinion is doing so. As we move closer and closer to elections, that will also lead to further changes here as well.
Let's try to get another last caller on here. Dan, that's you. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a degree in political science, which so maybe I follow politics more than the average American. But, you know, I mean, I listen to the debates. I go look at candidates' voting records. I'll go to their websites and see what the issues they support. And I don't really go to Facebook to influence me on elections. So I'm wondering, I mean, do people really go that much and look at that, or is this much ado about nothing? I got to think that all this other stuff, the debates and the things, influence more than Facebook. Are Americans that influenced by Facebook in the elections?
Well, what we do see, Dan, I think it's a very good point, is that as candidates, as voters have more information about candidates up the ticket, what we see is Facebook merely influencing that or reinforcing those views. But down ballot, those local races, that's where those drop-in ads can be important in setting the narrative.
That'll end it. I thank you so much for being with us, David McEwen. Good to have you.
Thank you very much for having me, Michael.
David McEwen, again, is professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Sonoma State. Earlier, we spoke with Jennifer Epstein, White House reporter for Bloomberg, and Scott Chain, reporter for the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Hour coming up, we're going to talk about John Marshall and Chief Justice John Marshall and his times, a book without precedent by Hastings Law professor Joel Richard Paul. Really gives us not only the extraordinary contribution that John Marshall made to the United States and its political system, but also his life. Stay tuned for that. It's up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.